Thank you for joining us here, Professor Neda Hashemi, again, Professor of Middle East and Islamic Politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and co-editor of this new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Glad to be with you.
And I was mentioning the leadership struggles. It is a bit Byzantine. Apparently, the problems, I guess, are centered around Ahmadinejad's chief of staff, who's apparently a contentious figure. And I think the intelligence chief was bugging both Ahmadinejad and his chief of staff. Then when Ahmadinejad found out about this, he fired the intelligence chief. And then the supreme leader, who's the actual power in Iran, enforced his reinstatement of the intelligence chief. Ahmadinejad refused, boycotted cabinet meetings for about a week, I think, and then basically came back to the cabinet meetings with his tail between his leg, with the intelligence chief reinstated. So,
you've just summarized Iranian politics better than I ever could.
But tell me though about what's behind this. I mean, clearly it is a system where you have a supreme leader. The very name suggests that. And most people have confused Ahmadinejad as a real leader. His powers have always been circumscribed. He's been something of a lightning rod. But in this current struggle, it's almost as if he's a liberal and these other guys are conservatives. I mean, how would you characterize
it? Well, we can use the word liberal in relationship to Ahmadinejad. I think it's really a question of a political struggle between different factions within Iran's conservative hardline community for different pieces of the political pie. There's no really, you know, set of ethical or political principles here that are at stake other than a naked grab for power. And you're right to allude to the fact that the key sort of figure here that has been identified as the source of the problem is Ahmadinejad's chief of staff, this person who has a striking resemblance actually to a Karl Rove-like character, the genius behind the throne, who is mentoring and is really the architect for Ahmadinejad's sort of policies, both international and domestic, and is also have these delusions of grandeur and aspirations for greater political power. And there's a sense that power is starting to shift within Iran's political system away from the office of the supreme leader, where it is really concentrated, and toward the office of the presidency. And this battle over the Ministry of Intelligence is really critical because, as you know, in authoritarian regimes, it's the Ministry of Intelligence that controls domestic society. And so who controls that minister has a huge amount of leverage in terms of how they can pursue policies and project power domestically. So it's really a factional struggle, it seems like the supreme leader has won and that Ahmadinejad has been forced to back down. And he's effectively acting now as really a lame duck president, and the aspirations that he and his chief of staff had for some sort of legacy of political power beyond 2013, when there's supposed to be another presidential election, have been shot down.
But in this context, you have the overall fraudulent election in 2009 that led to the Green Movement, the revolution amongst mostly the young and the mm-hmm. educated and the women mm-hmm. and the urban professionals against the regime. The regime and the leaders of this revolution were themselves Ayatollahs, but obviously somewhat more less conservative.
Well, they weren't Ayatollahs. They were supporters of the revolution.
Karubi and
right, high-ranking members of and supporters of the Islamic Revolution, who over the course of the last 30 years sort of started to carve out an independent sort of reformist trajectory. And now after the 2009 election are effectively in opposition to the political system, although rhetorically their political platform is still one of reform, respecting the Constitution. It's really a civil rights right. movement than an anti-establishment.
But they've essentially been shut down
right.
along with the Green Movement.
Absolutely.
And that is what presumably the LA Times is referring to in its front lead article in today's paper, Shades of Iran in the Syrian Crackdown.
A lot of resemblance,
that,
actually.
That they showed how you can crush a revolution, which, of course, the Egyptian regime failed to do and the Tunisian regime failed to do.
Correct.
But on the other side, you've got Gaddafi and Assad and in Bahrain as well.
Yeah, and in Yemen.
So why is it in your new book, Nader Hashemi, the People Reloaded, the Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future, which you've co-edited, why is there a sense of optimism that this can be reversed? Is this you're talking about over the long term?
I'm talking over the long term, but not the extreme long term. I mean, one sort of point that I would like to make about as to why I'm optimistic about Iran's democratic prospects is the battle for ideas inside the Islamic Republic of Iran is really over. And the Green Movement, the reformist movement, the intellectuals, the people who were in the streets 2 years ago have really won that battle. And there's a lot of evidence that one can point to. The regime in Iran right now is really paranoid and spends a lot of energy and time and money in trying to repress and censor free and public debate. There's massive censorship that has taken place. There's no freedom for political parties. Iran has distinguished itself by imprisoning all of the leading journalists and intellectuals. And that's actually really revealing if you think about it. Mm-hmm. Because what do journalists do? They convey information. What do intellectuals do? They deal with ideas. The regime is paranoid over a public debate about the state of human rights in Iran, about this concept of the rule of the clergy, about the record of the Islamic Republic over the last 30 years. It goes out of its way to prevent, to block satellite transmission because it knows that if there ever is a free and public debate, the regime will lose. And that's a positive sign of how the battle for ideas are really sort of over in Iran, and now it's a question of street battles for advancing a democratic cause.
But it seems to me that mentally – people have moved on. This government's irrelevant to their lives. I mean, it's the government in power, but it's actually a mafia. And in fact, a mafia within a mafia competing for, because of the IRGC, the Guards Corps, they get the oil money. Who knows? Nobody even knows how the state budget is appropriated. Right. And so is that what you're saying, that the people are essentially in a state of smoldering revolt? It's the embers beneath the ashes, I think, is the analogy that's being used.
Yeah, actually, that's a quote from the Iranian Nobel Prize laureate, one of the heroes of the Green Movement, Shirin Ebadi, who actually described Iranian politics as sort of a situation where you have sort of embers, a fire burning beneath the embers. But I need to point out here, this is what's distinct about Iran in comparison to Tunisia and in Egypt. Iran and its regime does have a core constituency of support that is not very wide, but it is deep. And what I mean by that is that it has a small percentage of the population, I would put it at about 15-20%, that is deeply loyal ideologically to the supreme leader and buys into the propaganda of the regime.
So that would be the Basij militia, the rural poor.
But beyond that, the rural poor, there is – I mean the rhetoric of the regime does have a certain resonance within segments of the Iranian community. Mm. They buy into it. And the analogy –
even though they've been saying this forever?
Death
to America.
Yeah.
That still
it
works?
Does. It resonates. And the analogy that I would point to, my friend at in New York, the historian Ervan Abrahamian, pointed out that, here in the United States, you have a core constituency of conservative Republican support that will always vote for the Republican candidate regardless of who it is. Whether it's Palin or Donald Trump,
because they buy into that for whatever reason.
It's a similar situation in Iran.
Right, right. Because when Nixon was impeached and went away in shame, he still had 30%
there
support.
There you go. There you go. So, there is that constituency that buys into it, and the regime is able to immunize itself from criticism and maintain that support because it uses two sort of ideological campaigns and arguments that Mubarak and Ben Ali could not use. Number one, it invokes the claim of Islamic authenticity, that if you're pious and practicing Muslim, you have to buy into this regime. If you don't, you're destined to hell and you're not a good Muslim. That's something that Mubarak, who was a general secular, could not sort of invoke. The second thing that the regime invokes, and it gains some support, it invokes itself and wraps itself in the mantle of anti-imperialism. It has made the argument that the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the champion, is the leading sort of force opposing Western imperialism in the region. And given you know, the very sordid legacy, troubled legacy of Western intervention in the region, both in the past and in the present, that argument resonates among a core constituency of Iranians. It also resonates beyond Iran's borders. I mean, that's why Ahmadinejad, in these prior to these democratic revolutions in the Arab world, was one of the most popular political figures. They really milk that theme. It's related to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And so because of those two reasons, the regime is able to, you know, make these arguments that resonate in the minds of some people. But, you know, people who are, I think, educated, who are honest, who are sort of thoughtful, who, you know, have thought through these questions, you know, don't buy into the propaganda and don't believe that the supreme leader is God's representative on earth. And so I think that's something that's different in terms of Iran's internal politics that separates it from Tunisia and Egypt. And as a consequence, it makes the struggle for democracy in Iran that much more difficult, because these are obstacles that pro-democratic forces have to overcome. And they're obstacles that, you know, Democrats in Tunisia and Egypt did not have to face.
But the other dynamic, surely, with the Arab Spring is democracy versus theocracy. And we know that both Gaddafi and Mubarak used the specter of an al-Qaeda-type theocracy. Without us, you get the without our dead hand of a dictatorship, you end up with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Iranian regime did try to exploit that in the sense that the Arab Spring was really about a theocratic uprising.
Right.
And, of course, it turns out that the Egyptian kids are probably the same as the Iranian kids and the Syrian kids. And that's what, to me, I see in common with throughout the entire Arab Spring.
No, I agree. I mean,
it's not about that. Everybody that's on the streets that's brave enough to face tanks and bullets want the same thing. It's just a degree to which these dictatorships are prepared to be ruthless. And the Iranian dictatorship was the first to show its hand.
Yeah, and now it's advising the Syrian regime in terms of how it can crack down on peaceful, nonviolent protests. In fact, you know, reading the really
but
horrific
why,
news,
why
it's very similar.
Why does anybody, though, in the European left and in the American left support? It seems to me that there's a crisis political and moral irrelevance here for the left. If they support Gaddafi, which many do, believe it or not, even though he's just because he spouts some revolutionary rhetoric, his billionaire brat kids driving around in Ferraris,
he's a bloodthirsty
billions
dictator.
Still the same. They support the Hamas people, who in turn support the Syrians and call the people in the streets dying for their freedom, terrorists. Mm-hmm. There are some really dead ideas out there.
There are dead ideas out there, and I think thankfully that segment of the left, the North American left, Western left, in my view, is very small. They're vocal, but they're small, and they're out there. And I think it really reflects the poverty of their own thinking. It's an inability to sort of think in a nuanced way.
They didn't notice that Hugo Chavez got the 2005. Gaddafi Prize for Human Rights?
Yeah, well, see, they're so obsessed with anti-imperialism that they forget that there are other forms of oppression that exist in the world and that are responsible for a lot of bloodshed. Gaddafi's, 42-year rule, you can't sort of blame that on Western imperialism. He has to take some responsibility, as in the case of Bashar Assad, Iranian Ayatollah. So it's a position that doesn't stand up to critical scrutiny. I really wish my friend Danny Postel, my co-editor, was here, because he's actually, very articulate and eloquent in terms of his critique and diagnosis of the left and its that segment of the left that's supportive and sympathetic to the Ahmadinejads and the Hugo Chavezes and the Gaddafis.
So obviously that's not the subject of our conversation, although I'm certainly going to bring it up with Chris Hedges coming up later in the program. The subject really is about whether Iran can free itself from this theocratic rule and from this kind of mafia bleeding that's going on. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to follow it as best I can. And, of course, here in Los Angeles, we have a substantial Iranian diaspora, somewhat divided, I would say, to put it politely, right?
Many ways, yeah.
In many ways, between royalists and various factions. Mm-hmm. And when you say that the regime is spending all of its time now suppressing dissent, does that mean that all these broadcasts that come out of LA are being jammed?
They are, but the one actually satellite transmission that the regime is really obsessed about, and for I think all the right reasons, is the BBC Persian service. About a year ago, BBC Persia, the BBC service in Persian started to broadcast in Iran, and if anyone who's seen the program and can speak Persian, I think will agree with me that it is probably the it is a very high quality production. It's really excellent analysis. And in many ways, I tell people that in a future democratic Iran, I would like to see the model of the BBC Persian reproduced for the state television. It's honest. It has really good sort of critical discussion and debate. And the regime in Iran, very interestingly and revealing, is paranoid over the BBC Persian. And you have to ask yourself why. What crime has BBC Persian television station done that has freaked this regime out to its foundation? And the answer simply is it is reporting the news honestly, independently. It has critical debate. It invites intellectuals. It's really, you know, sophisticated technology and with all the sounds and lights and mm-hmm. It's really an interesting, engaging program. And the fact that the Iranian regime goes out of its way to block the BBC Persian television. It also does it to the Voice of America, but it has a particular angst and mm-hmm. and sensitivity, reveals, and I think, you know, speaks to the point that I made earlier that this regime is paranoid over the free flow of information because it knows it can't win a public debate. And so it goes out of its way to suppress the transmission of
technology. In the 2009 crackdown, they went after some BBC reporters. They arrested some guy for espionage. My understanding is that the British intelligence people froze the funds belonging to the Supreme Leader's son, about $1.8 billion. That would give you an idea of what a mafia they are and how much money they're stealing.
Yeah.
And that led to
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think it probably is beyond simply BBC Persian television. But you know, you see it in the rhetoric and the debate, and people in Iran with great difficulty can access BBC Persian television, and the regime goes out of its way to censor that particular program, as opposed to some of the extreme sort of royalist programs here in Los Angeles that no one in Iran really takes seriously. But it's the BBC Persian because it's honest, it has a lot of integrity, and really high quality analysis and debate, and that's what the regime is fearful of.
Well, let's just in the last minute then try and figure out how this regime's dead hand will be pried loose from the people who are obviously over it mentally, but they can't get rid of it physically. And in many ways, it seems to me very similar to some of the discussions I've had with Saudi dissidents, that one of the things that we get wrong is we always assume that these theocratic regimes are intractable and inevitable. But actually, they do create a backlash. I mean, it's similar to, for example, how the children of hippies end up being button-down Republicans, mm-hmm. and the extent to which religious oppression in Saudi Arabia has created a whole generation of kids who just can't stand this stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if there's a revolution, they'll end up being a fairly secular state.
Yeah, and a similar trend in Iran.
Do you think the same? Because that's what I hear about Iran, that they just are so fed up with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is that there is a very strong, what I would say, secular movement within Iran. And an important part of that movement are people from the religious classes, from within the religious seminaries, who realizes that this close union of religion and state has been a tragedy not only for politics but also for religion. And so the ability for the regime to justify the current political order where clerics are in power, something that can't be publicly sustained in free and open debate. And there is this backlash. If there's ever an opportunity really for people to express their views, to write a new constitution, you can be sure that one of the key principles in a future democratic constitution in Iran will be a key principle of secularity. You know, the separation, particularly of religion and state, because, you know, over the last 30 years, the lessons that Iranians have learned is that it's been a catastrophe for their society, for their country.
Well, I thank you so much for dropping by the studio here, Professor Nader Hashemi. And again, you'll be having this conversation further at the forum tonight at the Levantine Cultural Center, 5998 West Pico Boulevard. At 7 p.m., along with Reza Aslan and Professor Mohammed Sahimi. And again, we're very grateful for you dropping by and for your new book that you co-edited, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
And hello again. I'm Ian Masters, and this is a Background Briefing. And we are going to be joined now by the station program director, Alan Minsky, who is going to help me pitch. We'll be pitching both the book that we just talked about, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. This is a book we're offering up for a $100 donation to Background Briefing at 818-985-5735. And I'm operating on the assumption that given the vast Iranian diaspora here in Los Angeles, that there might well be a number of people who are interested in this book, which is a collection of important works by prominent Iranian intellectuals and political scientists and observers about Iran's future and this movement within this country that is controlled by this theocracy that's having its own dysfunctional internal battles as well. So it's a very, very rich piece of work here, this book, which and Alan Minsky, you're going to help me pitch this book for a minute, and then before we go to Chris Hedges.
Sure. I really think this looks utterly fantastic. A Nobel Prize-winning author recommends it very highly. A gentleman whose name is pronounced Pamuk. Pamuk has the Turkish author, won the Nobel Prize in literature, recommends this book very highly, one of the great writers alive today. And it seems like a fascinating book, and it's a great interview and dialogue you just had with Ian Masters. And remember, when you pick up the book here, first of all, it's important that you're supporting independent media, KPFK radio, community radio here in Southern California. And it's the only place where you can get Ian's interview.
Well, before Professor Hashemi leaves us, because I know you've got to get across to the Levantine Cultural Center on 5998 West Pico Boulevard, give our audience a sense of what the book brings to the table and why it's important that they should get it, particularly the Iranian-American audience.
The book basically chronicles the first year of the Green Movement from the June 2009 sort of election until the first anniversary of that movement. And it's a collection of the best sort of writing analysis by Iranian scholars, intellectuals, and also it has important sort of interviews and documents that previously have not appeared in English. We translate the Green Movement charter. There's a great open letter from one of the student leaders, political prisoners, that he's released from jail. So it's a collection of documents, interviews, and also analysis that sort of summarize, contextualize, and give a broad overview of really what this movement is about and where it's headed.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Really appreciate it.